grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to episode 240 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. If you're a fan of books like I am and just don't have time to thumb a page anymore, make sure to stop on by audibletrial.com/dudesandbeer. That is where you can get your 30-day free trial of Amazon's Audible. Tons of books, tons of categories, tons of genres, tons of authors. Stop on by audibletrial.com/dudesandbeer today to get your 30-day free trial. We have a great sound clip this evening. Let's check it out. It is a little bit from the 40th anniversary of the Greenstone with our guest this evening, Graham Phillips.
1980, Central England, an abandoned Victorian house. Walls crumble, floors rot, and ceilings collapse. Not over years, but weeks. Here, a building is inexplicably falling apart, as is the fabric of reality itself. The occupants have fled, forced out by mysterious accidents, unexplained noises, terrifying apparitions, and objects that unaccountably move by themselves. But this is no haunted house. Here, events from the past, the future, and alternative versions of the present are merging as one. Can it be stopped or even contained? What if it can't? This is no supernatural or science fiction tale, attested to by dozens of witnesses. Unfortunately, this story is true.
Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. The voice you were just hearing narrating this incredible tale of the Greenstone. Graham Phillips, how are you doing this evening, sir?
I'm very well. It is now 2 o'clock at middle of the night.
Yes.
In central England.
It is the merry, merry morning for you over there. I know you have a stock full register of shows to be on today from what you were telling me earlier. So we will keep things nice and tight this evening on the schedule for you to make sure that you make all of those properly. For me, I absolutely love speaking with you about topics like the Greenstone, about topics like your book, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. For me, as someone who has been into these topics for years, stuff like this, King Arthur, the Holy Grail, you are one of the only authors and researchers that takes on these topics and not only takes them on from their lore, but from a historical aspect as well, and weaves the two together in such a great, amazing form of storytelling. The Greenstone just landed on my doorstep today, and I am probably about 50 pages into it, but have been poring over the internet since you came out with the 40th anniversary release, everything else. Tell our audience a little bit about your history with the Greenstone, about what the Greenstone is exactly.
Okay, well, it all happened pretty much exactly 40 years ago. It started around about now, in October of 1979. Now, to give you a bit of a history to what was happening then, I was a very young man, mid-20s, and I was the editor of a magazine called Strange Phenomena, which you can obviously guess from the title, investigated all sorts of mysteries and the paranormal. There was also a organization, a paranormal research group that ran in conjunction with it called Parasearch. And the magazine and the Paranormal Research Group was based in an old rambling Victorian house in a town called Wolverhampton, which is in central England. And it all began, until this point, we had investigated the paranormal. I'd seen a few strange things, but nothing exceptional. But one of the mysteries that we began to investigate started the whole thing off. And that concerned, it wasn't a paranormal investigation to start off with. This is more of an historical mystery. And it concerned a green, small green stone that was once supposed to have been possessed by the deposed monarch Mary, Queen of Scots, in the 1500s. It was once kept on her ring. It was said to have had all sorts of supernatural properties. After her death, it was hidden, and a series of clues were supposed to have been left to lead to where it was. And it was the investigation into, well, let's see if we can solve these clues. Let's see if we can find this green stone of the truth behind the legend that actually started this incredible adventure.
And that adventure has been going on for, like you said, right at 40 years now. And some of the things that have happened to the people surrounding the green stone, the places that the green stone has been, has the green stone been found again? Because the green stone went missing, correct?
Yeah, it's we don't know where it is at the moment. So if anybody out there has any idea, please tell me. But I think I better explain first how we found it, if that's okay.
Yeah. Let's get into, of course, how you found the green stone to begin with.
Okay, then. Right. Well, the legend was that in 1605, the stone was hidden. And a series of clues were supposedly hidden in a Tudor mansion, a 400-year-old building, not far from where we had the headquarters of the magazine and the research group, a place called Kidderminster, again in the centre of England. And then this country house, this Elizabethan manor house, there was a man who lived in the early 1600s called Humphrey Packington. Mm. He was supposedly part of an organisation called the Order of Nehemiah, a secret society that was said to have been founded by the Elizabethan astrologer and occultist Dr. John Dee. And he had gotten hold of this stone, this group had got hold of this stone, and because of persecutions against people involved in the occult in the early 1600s, the stone was hidden. But this man, Humphrey Packington, at his home of Harvington Hall, this Elizabethan manor house, is said to have left a series of clues to lead to its location for some future member of the group to find. But that was just the story. Myself and the chief researcher for the group, who may have been on your show before, Andrew Collins?
No, but I have contacted him to be on the show.
Ah, well, he's like me. Over the last four decades, he's written all sorts of books about historical and other mysteries. But we're in, as I say, we're just in our 20s at that point. Myself and him went along to this Harvington Hall and probably expecting to find nothing, but to ask the people who were running the place, because it was open to the public, if they knew any more about this legend. And astonishingly, they told us that shortly before we got there, there'd been renovations to the building. And in an upstairs corridor, sealed up behind wooden panelling, they discovered a wall mural, this huge painting that had been on the wall for 400 years. And it seemed to be completely cryptic in nature. And they suddenly said to us that they think that this is the series of clues that were said to lead to the whereabouts of this green stone. And you could still make out the picture on the wall, and they'd only recently rediscovered it. They said the reason they think this, that it is the clues that might have been alluded to in the legend, is because they'd been deliberately boarded up 400 years ago by this man, Humphrey Packington. Why do that unless you're leaving a secret message of some kind? To cut a very long story short, we realised that the central figure of it basically was called the Nine Worthies because it represented nine heroic characters from history and legend. And the central character portrayed was a youthful King Arthur wielding the magic sword Excalibur. And behind him, his knights were gathered on a hill. That was the picture. Cutting a long story short, we eventually worked out that this picture related to a place in the local landscape. Just a few miles away from Harvington Hall, there was a hill actually called Knight's Hill. In the painting, Arthur's knights are gathered on a hill. And just below this hill, there was this old bridge overlooking a lake, which dated from the period of time when this painting was done. And it was known locally as Arthur's Bridge. So you've got a hill called Knight's Hill. You've got Arthur's Bridge below it. The central theme for these paintings was King Arthur with a bridge, with a hill behind him with his knights on it. So that's where we decided to go. But this is where it starts to get a bit spooky, because just before we set off, only myself and Andrew Collins knew that we were going to look at this place called Knight's Hill and this bridge to see if there was anything there. As I say, it overlooked a lake. One of the people known to our magazine was a lady by the name of Marion Sunderland, and she was a psychic. She had a dream that she said to us, "You're not looking for a stone to start off with. You're looking for a sword that would lead you to a stone." Now, that was pretty bizarre, because we'd just been looking at pictures of a sword, the King Arthur sword wielded by the figure in these paintings. But she said that in this dream that she'd seen a still lake. Well, that's where we were going. I mean, this was years before they had cell phones, so she was phoning us up before we left the office. So she had no idea we were going to a lake. She had no idea that the search involved a sword. But she said she saw a sword on a block of stone, and she thought that's what we were looking for first, and then that sword in turn would lead us to the green stone. But then a few minutes later, there was another phone call from a man called Alan Beard. He was a family friend of one of the researchers in the group. He'd had this vision, apparently, when he was just sitting at his desk in his office, I seem to remember, and he said he saw a green stone in this vision that had once been set in a silver ring. He knew nothing that we were searching for a green stone. He wasn't directly involved with us. And he said also, he said that this green stone's hidden somewhere, but he believes that we should firstly be searching for a sword that would eventually lead us to this green stone. And in his vision, he had like a vision, if you like, and he said he saw a holly bush, and that holly bush stood where the sword would be found. So we were kind of like gobsmacked when we set off going to this lake, because we thought, well, how are these people, you know, picking up these messages? Yeah. I mean, could there really be something there? And when we got to the bridge, we finally figured out that in the picture, Arthur is looking down and to his left. Now, if you stood on the bridge to your left with the hill, Knight's Hill, behind you, as is depicted in the painting, the hill with Arthur's knights is behind him, and look down to your left, you look at the foundation stone, so that part of the bridge overlooking the lake. And ultimately, we decided, well, if it is hidden behind one of these foundation stones, that maybe nine across and nine down, that stone should be removed. Now, it would have been impossible to remove beforehand. I mean, it was covered in brambles and vegetation. And when eventually we got there, we managed finally to remove this stone. and were completely gobsmacked, because there, in a recess behind the stone, lying on a stone slab, just as Marion had said, was a short sword or long dagger, heavily encrusted with years of sediment.
And that is where I've been in the story so far, is right as y'all come across this sword of Meonia. Where did that lead y'all? Once y'all had this amazing clue in your hands that obviously was something that was more than likely leading y'all to it, it seems like, just by all extraordinary means possible. And how did that strike you as a historian, a researcher, to find something like that in such a way?
Well, I mean, firstly, I was absolutely thrilled that we'd managed to solve some 400-year-old historical mystery. We'd actually decoded this thing, this painting. But obviously we hadn't found a green stone like we were originally looking for, but we'd found something that was hidden there. It was taken to a museum, and it was cleaned up and found to be it was about 20 inches long with a 2-inch cross guard. It was made from one single casting of steel, and it was said to have been that it was identified as a dirk, which is an old ornamental Scottish sword. Now, until this point, I'm thinking, is this just some kind of weird coincidence? It was pretty exciting finding it, because when we found it, it was actually dark. We'd been hanging around there for ages to solve the clues, and when eventually we hit on this idea of what stone to look behind and so on, it was dark, so it was pretty kind of spooky, I suppose, to suddenly find this sword there in the middle of the night. But until then, I was thinking, it's got to be some kind of coincidence. Maybe putting swords in bridges was mason sign or something. But when the sword was cleaned up, it had on its cross guard the embossed the personal insignia of the very person who was once said to have possessed this stone, Mary, Queen of Scots, and her symbol was actually marked on it. So we thought, well, the two things definitely tie up. And along its blade was written the words in Elizabethan spelling, Meonia, for Mary. Well, Meonia had been the name of the society that had hidden the stone. So we thought, wow, on an historical level, this is pretty big stuff, and somehow this sword must hold clues to where this stone is. But remember, the legend was that the stone held some kind of supernatural power.
Yeah.
And what was even more weird, of course, than just finding the sword, was the fact that two people had completely independently, and this is before the days of social media where people put things on Facebook and communicate with each other on cell phones. These people from different parts of the country who had no knowledge of what we were doing and didn't know each other had come up with visions saying that, oh, you're going to find a sword. And the lady had said we were going to find it by a still lake on top of a stone. She'd also said there'd be a strange, overwhelming smell of rotting vegetation when we found it. And that was true. But remember this other guy, Alan Beard, who had also had a dream of a green stone and also saying we should find a sword, said a holly bush would be nearby. Well, there was a huge holly bush directly above where we found this thing. So, because supernatural things were happening to us, I was beginning to believe that maybe this stone we were looking for really did have some kind of supernatural powers.
Well, and that to me is the most amazing part, because when the stone does get found, strange things start happening. Odd things start happening. What is some of the hidden history behind the stone before we get into the connection between the sword and the stone and the finding of the stone itself? Let's get into a little bit of the Rosicrucians and secret orders that were tied to the possession of the stone.
Okay, the people who had this stone, at the time, we didn't know hardly anything about the deeper history behind it. That's all been worked out since. And I'm working on a new book as we speak, which is all about who this order of Nehemiah actually was. So I can tell you quite a lot about it, which we didn't know at the time. But basically, the order of Nehemiah was founded in, I think it was, let me get the date straight off of my brain without looking on the computer, in 1572, a new star seemed to have appeared in the heavens. Now, we know now it was not a star appearing out of nowhere. It was actually a supernova, an exploding star, which suddenly became visible for many months from Earth, where no star seemed to have been before. And these events are really rare. They only happen every few centuries in the Milky Way, on average. So nobody had actually really seen anything like this before. And because the only thing that people could make some kind of link with a new star appearing in the skies, is obviously in the Bible, when a new star proclaims the birth of Christ.
Yeah.
Well, people began to believe, because this star had appeared in the constellation of Cygnus the Swan, that this star was the astrological interpretation of this, because the swan was a symbol of enlightenment, that this held a new age of enlightenment. And the person who became the chief astrologer to Queen Elizabeth I, who was on the throne in England at the time in 1572, remember back then, Elizabeth wasn't that against things like the occult and astrology.
Oh, I'm sure.
Wasn't
of course
considered
not.
Witchcraft back then. That was much later. And so this influential and rich guy, Dr. John Dee, began to write all about what this star might mean. It's a new age of enlightenment and discovery. And a lot of these things were happening. It's the time of the beginning of science. It's the time when the first voyages to the new world were taking place, to North America. The first English colony in North America was founded, and so on. So it was a new age. But some people also believed that it was a new age of spiritual or mystical enlightenment.
Yeah,
and they went round grabbing or getting hold of various artifacts that they believed were important. And one of these was this green stone that had been in the possession of the royal family of Scotland for centuries, that had belonged to Mary Queen of Scots when she was executed in the 1580s, 1587, if I remember right. Before she was executed, this stone was given to this group, the Order of Nehemiah, that had been founded by Dr. John Dee. Why Nehemiah? Well, it's quite a long story, but basically Nehemiah in ancient Greek means a swan. So it's kind of named after the symbol, the constellation in which the star appeared. So this group had this green stone. It was supposed to be in the writings they wrote, and they later became a larger organization known as the Rosicrucians, who you mentioned. And the writings of this group and the Rosicrucians refer to this green stone as something called the lapis exilis. It is said to be able to, well, in modern terms, it was said to have the power over time and life. It could bend time. It could bend reality. It was their most prized possession. And they wrote about it being hidden in 1605. And shortly after, their order disbanded because of the persecutions of the church throughout Europe.
Yeah. And this is one that is rumored to have literally the properties of an infinity stone, being able to change time, space around it, being able to grant life, destroy life. A whole range of properties were attributed to this stone.
Absolutely. It was set, it goes back well before their time. Some of the legends associated it with King Solomon and the building of the Temple of Jerusalem and the power that he had to summon angels. Other stories told about it going back to ancient Egypt and being made by an Egyptian pharaoh by the name of Akhenaten. There's all sorts of stories behind it, but it was said to be one of the... It's not very well known. It's not like the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant, which appears in the Bible and we all know about. It's a lesser-known object, but one that really seems to have been one of the most powerful, in legend anyway, relics of ancient history.
Well, and as someone who is... quite literally devoted their life to the finding of things like the Mountain of God, the Staff of Moses. How did the search for the Green Stone affect you? How did it change you? How did it change the way that you processed cases and information whenever it came to you? Because of course it's got this legendary history behind it, but you were one of the few people to have shared presence with the Green Stone, to have been fortunate or unfortunate as the case may be to have been around it. What has that been like for you?
Well, you mentioned that I've gone in search of the Mountain of God, or the true Mount Sinai, as it's called in the Bible, and I've gone in search of the Ark of the Covenant.
Man, you're like a modern-day actual Indiana Jones.
Yeah, literally. Well, actually, literally. The name modern-day Indiana Jones is actually applied to me by George Lucas himself, when Lucasfilms made a documentary about people who'd actually gone in search of items that Indiana Jones had done. So I haven't just come off the top. I haven't come up with that title off the top of my head.
Well, all right.
But what we were doing with the Green Stone, it was before all this. The Indiana Jones films haven't been out. It was before all this, and my searches for these various relics, such as the Holy Grail and so forth, that hadn't started. It was the discovery of this Green Stone that got me interested in all that.
Oh.
And well, but first of all, obviously, the discovery of the sword. And I was interested in the paranormal. I'd witnessed a couple of little things myself. I was primarily a journalist. Before working for this magazine that investigated the paranormal, I'd been a radio journalist for the BBC, just covering ordinary, everyday stories. So I wasn't that fascinated by the historical mysteries. It was just a case to me at the time for the magazine. And I'd obviously have an interest in the paranormal. But this is what started it all off 40 years ago today.
Oh, wow.
Well, pretty much today anyway. And that's what, I mean, the book we wrote about all this, which you spoke about at the beginning, The Green Stone, came out in 1979 or 80. And it had so much weird stuff in it that I think it sold well, but it kind of has been forgotten for 40 years. This was happening around about the same time as the Amityville Horror story was going on. And so people were interested and knew about ghosts and poltergeists and all that, but the idea of finding ancient relics and stuff and the kind of weird, like, time shifts and all that sort of stuff that eventually happened after we found the stone, that was something that people are far more into today because of the way that, you know, science fiction and paranormal stories are told. Back then, most people, it was just haunted houses or vampires, and that's it. You know, the sort of things we were doing, searching for artifacts years before anything to do with the Da Vinci Code, it was just, I think, too much for people.
Yeah, well, and I think I think it's one of those, it's a story, it's intangible. You know, why would you look for something that is fable? You know, I think is the mentality that most people would have when, as we discussed with the Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, what is fable is based on fact at some point. These stories didn't just come around, and they weren't just told by this culture and that culture for no good reason. You know, they didn't take careful care to not only craft these stories, but to actively keep them alive in their subculture for no good reason.
Yeah, and the thing about this is that the search for the sword was amazing enough. The search for the stone that went after this is a bit complicated, so I'll keep it very simple. One of the things that happened is one of the people involved thought of holding the sword and that it would somehow be able to lead them in the general direction of it by using it as some kind of divining rod. That was just a theory that came up. And when they did that, they actually saw in their mind's eye an image of a swan. Now, they didn't know anything about the fact that the Order of Myonia was named after a swan.
Yeah.
That had actually been founded because of a new star that appeared in the constellation of Cygnus the Swan.
Yeah, as a cult of Cygnus, basically.
But the interesting thing is, the place where this star had appeared, there was two other stars that appeared around the year 1600, which also influenced this secret society. But I'll just talk about one of them, which wasn't actually a supernova. It's known today by astronomers to be a variable star. It's a star that suddenly brightened up to be invisible to the naked eye beforehand, but then suddenly became visible. And in the year 1600, another star appeared in the constellation of Cygnus the Swan. Now, if you were to look at the night sky with the naked eye and wait for the appearance of a new star, even if you could have a 360-degree view of the whole Earth, you'd probably have to wait 100 years before you're likely to see one. In fact, there hasn't been one since for 400 years almost. I mean, you know, that's how rare it is. So for another star to suddenly appear in the constellation of Cygnus the Swan, this order, this group, the Order of Myonia, considered that to be really portentous for some kind of, for something to happen. Because they'd already got started because another star appeared in that same constellation. The star is recorded by the father of modern astrology, Johann Kepler, in 1600. It was known as Kepler's star. Kepler's star was 4 years later. That was a supernova. But it's recorded by Johann Kepler in 1600, this brightening of a normal star. And it's recorded as appearing in the constellation of the Swan, in the Swan's neck, and very close to where we'd found the sword, there is a bend in the river Avon, a big meander, that's known as, and it's on all the maps, and it's on the maps going way back to the 1500s, it's called the Swan's Neck. And at that location, there was an old mound. We dug into it, and 3 or 4 feet down, discovered a hidden brass casket, a brass casket. Literally, it is about, 8 inches wide, 4 inches deep, 4 inches, 8 inches long, 4 inches wide, 4 inches deep. It was heavy brass. It was completely encrusted with years of sediment. It had to be taken to a museum, cleaned up eventually. But inside, there was a green stone. What? It was about 3/4 of an inch long, 1/2 inch wide, flat on the bottom and rounded on the top, as if it had been set in a ring. Mm. And since that time, we've compared it with paintings painted of Mary Queen of Scots wearing this silver ring in which this green stone was said to have been placed. And they're identical. So we'd found the green stone that this legend had spoken about. And because the sword itself was handed over to the person whose land it was on. And a strange coincidence is that the Earl of Coventry, the man who actually, Lord Coventry, who owned that land, donated it to a local museum, and it's still there on the wall to be seen today. So if anybody visits central England, goes to a town called Upton-upon-Severn, goes into a museum called the Tudor House Museum, and you will see the sword we found. It's on display with all information about it. It just turns out, by sheer chance, this museum happens to have been the home of Dr. John Dee, very man who founded the order the sword belonged to. So it's like weird sort of, is that what they call a meaningful coincidence?
Yeah, I would say they would call that a more than meaningful coincidence.
Synchronicity, I believe, is the term that Sigmund Freud thought up for it. Yeah. Meaningful coincidence or fate.
Yeah.
But the stone, nobody could decide whose land that was on. So we just got to keep it. So the sword and the stone and the casket, it's made, by the way, the people might be thinking, what's the stone made of? Out of? Just ordinary jade. It's not made out of anything peculiar or some stone that isn't, known element. It's made of jade. So we thought, okay, we've had some psychic things take place during the search for this, like the person who held the sword seeing a swan and other people know we were looking for a sword first. But I didn't really believe that the stone had any kind of paranormal properties until all hell started breaking loose at the offices of our magazine.
And I mean, so much so that it was written up in regular newspapers, everything else. Explain some of the goings on at Paranormal Magazine at the height of all this. What were some of the things that y'all were experiencing on the regular, Graham?
Okay, well, first of all, there's about 12 to 15 people working there at any one time. It's a big, rambling old Victorian house. It's your typical, if you want to imagine what a typical haunted house looks like, that's what the building was, basically. It looked like your typical haunted house. But inside, it'd be nicely decorated, so you're okay. But it's a big building. So there's about 12 or 15 people working there, running the magazine, also doing the paranormal research. And we had plenty of visitors. So the reason I'm mentioning how many people were there and the visitors is because the kind of things I'm going to be telling you about were witnessed by dozens of people. So it's not just one or two people saying, I've seen this, it could be their imagination. I mean, this was independently witnessed by dozens of people. It started, now, what I must mention is, at first and for a long time, we never associated what was going on, the paranormal events, with the green stone. I mean, we thought that the weird things started to happen because we'd done a lot of paranormal experiments there.
Sure.
We'd got mediums had been there and we'd tested them. We'd held seances and all that. And we kind of generally thought that that is what started it. I didn't really think that the green stone actually had any power to do what was going on. Anyway, it began quite low key, really, with items fusing out. Electrical items would give us shocks unexpectedly, more so than you'd expect. Light bulbs began to blow or suddenly dim. Electrical appliances just kept going wrong. So we called in the electricity company, who said there's nothing wrong with the wiring. But then it sort of took another level when one evening, just as it got dark, so remember, it's this time of the year, and in this country, it gets dark by 5 o'clock or something. So people are still working. And around 5 o'clock, suddenly, the whole place filled with this kind of weird, grey, incense-smelling smoke. And it filled, like, the whole building. Different rooms, even behind closed doors and inside closets. I mean, it wasn't like as if it was coming from one location, but it stayed there for maybe 5 minutes and then dissipated uniformly throughout the building, pretty much as quickly as it had come. And I don't know, 15 people must have witnessed that.
Wow!
And we thought the only thing it could be that we looked for a fire, we couldn't find one. We thought that the wiring must be smouldering, so the electric company was called back in. They could find nothing to account for it. They went about the building with their own instruments to see if they could figure out if there's any heat build up behind the walls or anything. Nothing. But then the next day, at almost exactly the same time when it got dark, the smoke began to appear again, and the same thing happened. And for over a period of a week, every night as it got dark, the smoke appeared. And because this was, so many people were witnessing this, the local newspaper got hold of the story. So as you said, the press knew about it.
Yeah.
They sent journalists along. The journalists came along and tried to, this is some kind of trickery you're pulling to try and get publicity for your magazine or something. Well, explain it then. We even had the BBC television news turned up. Unfortunately, that time, we didn't all have digital cameras like we have on phones now, so we haven't got cameras rolling or video, but we did get it filmed by the BBC, who sent a news team along to witness things, this happening. And they went out of their way. They brought in some electronics expert to try and prove that we were faking this in some way. But no, it was, you know, no one could account for this strange smoke. So that's just the low-level stuff of how it began.
And like you said, this is what catalyzed you. This is what changed you from being just a normal reporter who did a little bit of paranormal stuff on the side, things like that, to someone that made this really their mission in life, to go out and find such objects and lend credence to the legendary history of things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was at this point determined to try and find some way myself that this could be happening. And when I insisted the electricity company literally virtually tear the place apart, or at least where the wiring, you know, the fuse boxes and stuff, and really, really look to try and explain how this is all happening. And when they did, they said that they were completely sort of mystified, because they said, it's almost as if something is drawing power off your electrical system. And when we eventually got the electricity bill through, which would normally be, I don't know, £100 back in those days, you know, $150 or something, it was like £2,000.
Wow.
Like $2,500 for like a 3-month electricity. I mean, we didn't have much electrical equipment in this place. And so once we refused to pay this, and because the electricity company decided that there was, you know, that there was something clearly wrong, although they couldn't find out what it was, they cut us off. So suddenly we had this rambling old Victorian building with no electricity. So we had to move the paranormal research bit and the magazine somewhere else, but we still had a year remaining on the lease. Now, then, I mean, things got really... While the removal company were moving stuff out of the property, they started... I mean, maybe they've seen about this on the news. It became quite well known that strange things are happening. But they claim that they saw office furniture moving around, like chairs, doors slamming and closing and opening on their own. Other people there claim to have actually seen things moving through the air. Now, some people got really scared about this and didn't want to go back in the building. But most of us, because remember, there's a paranormal research group involved, we're excited about the prospect of having what may be a poltergeist case so close to home.
Yeah.
And because we still retain the lease on this place, we went back into this now empty, dark building and started to do research. The person I originally wrote the Greenstone with, Martin Keatman, he was a student at the time helping with the magazine. He was the first person to actually see an object directly looking at it move on its own. There was a radio on a shelf over a fireplace in one of the office rooms, and he actually was looking at it when it rose into the air, lifted up, and then crashed onto the floor.
Whoa!
I mean, I myself, the first thing I witnessed, other than the smoke and the weird electrical anomalies, was when I was walking down a passageway upstairs in the building. Downstairs, walking down a passageway, and suddenly this heavy box of magazines that had been at the other end of the corridor went whizzing past my head and crashed into the door at the other end. And I turned around, nobody was there. There was no way anyone could have done that. Now, there were many other people who witnessed things moving around. People started hearing strange sounds like whispering voices. And people would singing, a strange singing, like someone singing a lullaby, heard in the distance.
That's always comforting.
Say again?
I said, that's always comforting.
Yeah, well, it didn't. Not the way this one sounded. It sounded like something you'd literally get out of some kind of horror movie in later years. People would today say, well, that's the kind of stuff you get in horror movies. Not back then, it wasn't. Horror movies then were kind of... not kind of... noises in the background. Now, people try to look down the cellars everywhere to try and find out where this was coming from. We had people visit there who had no way of knowing that people had heard this weird singing coming from the cellars. And yet they would hear the stories. They'd say, what's that singing sound coming from the cellars? So it's not as if everyone's being influenced by everybody else to hear the same things. You know, it's not about their imaginations. There was just too many witnesses that couldn't have contacted each other or known about what was being reported on a daily basis. But it all really got too much when one of the researchers, Andrew Collins, as I mentioned, decided to stay over in the place at night when it was abandoned. And he woke in the middle of the night to find flames leaping from his sleeping bag. I mean, he only managed to get out of it without being severely injured. I mean, incredibly, he wasn't burned. And no one could account for how that had happened. Because we hadn't got any lighting in there, there were candles. Remember, the electricity has been switched off. There were candles and flashlights, but there was no candles anywhere near him. He didn't smoke. There was no way he could have literally caught fire. But other strange kind of fiery phenomena took place. On one occasion, there was somebody had dropped a coin on the floor. I don't know what, but, you know, like a sort of like a penny or something, which had been dropped on the floor. And like loads of us saw what, which suddenly we noticed this red, and we could smell this weird smell, and there was like this red glow in the corner. And we could see that somehow this coin had suddenly become red hot and melted into the carpet. So these were the kind of weird things that were going on.
Wow. And at what point did y'all begin to attribute it to the greenstone to begin with? And when did the greenstone go missing?
Okay, well, as I say, this is taking place over a number of months. And sure. Again, no one's assuming the reason, a good reason not to assume it, I don't think, to do with the greenstone, is the greenstone was no longer in the building at this point. Once the electricity went off and we'd moved headquarters, it was somewhere else. So, you know, no one was assuming it had anything to do with the greenstone. But I think it got to a real kind of head when the apparitions began to appear. People began to see this figure dressed in Victorian clothes with like a top hat and a long frock coat, sort of like the way you see President Lincoln dressed, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
A lot of people would see that figure there inside the house. Other people claimed to see characters in what was contemporary clothing to that period. Like there was a woman in a sort of like a nightgown of the 1970s appeared and then just disappeared. On one occasion, so, because going back then it was the period of the punk rockers, and somebody actually sort of saw somebody dressed like a young man dressed with like the Mohican haircut thing like they used to have then, and leather trousers and stuff, standing in the front room, just standing there. And loads of people witnessed that. But I think the most incredible apparition was that people started seeing what can only be described as an Egyptian princess. I mean, she had the hair, a woman of about 20. She had the hair Egyptian style, like you see. I know Elizabeth Taylor dressed up as Cleopatra for the film, looked that kind of thing. I mean, we were getting all these characters from different periods of history, not just Victorian characters, as you'd imagine in a Victorian house, but seemingly people from alternative versions of the present. I mean, it was just weird. And then the place started falling apart. It had only been abandoned for a couple of months, and suddenly the plaster would start falling from the walls, the ceilings collapsed, the pipes would rust and burst. That the whole place began to mold over. On one occasion, this blue gelatinous substance started oozing from the walls. I mean, whatever that was, who knows? But it was almost as if time inside the house was passing at some kind of accelerated rate. And so at this point, we're thinking, what on earth is going on? I mean, this isn't any kind of ordinary haunting.
Yeah.
And it was then that Marion Sunderland, who was the person to actually, first person to have a psychic message about the fact that we were looking for a sword near a lake, got in touch with us, she phoned us up and said, you know, I've had this, I believe, to be a psychic dream, that what's causing what's going on in the headquarters of your magazine is that this green stone has somehow done it. It somehow has the power to bend the fabric of reality. And we said, well, it's not there any longer. How can it? She said, no, it may not be, but when you took it back, somehow it opened some kind of preternatural rift. And unless this green stone itself is somehow discharged, then this phenomena will not only carry on in the house, will spread beyond it. And she said that to do this, it had to be taken to some kind of local hallowed ground. And we took it. There was nine of us. I thought, well, this isn't going to stop anything, but let's see. I mean, she was right in her psychic message about the sword, so let's see what happens. So it was like nine of us. We went along to this old ruined monastic building just outside the town of Wolverhampton, where the house was. And it was literally in the countryside, old ruined, fallen, no roof on it, just ruined walls of this old priory, White Ladies Priory, as it was called. I think that was chosen because somebody had done some research suggesting that that's where the stone was originally fashioned or something. Mm. Marion felt that we should put the stone on this old burial mound, which lay about 50 yards from the priory, in amongst these trees and a small copse or wood. And she said that something would happen at exactly 9:30 that night when it was dark. The reason she came to this conclusion, I think, had something to do with the conjunction of planets or something. I can't remember. I was just going along with it. She placed the stone on this burial mound amongst these trees. We all retreated to the priory. She said it was much the safest thing to do. We stood inside the walls of the priory, and at pretty much exactly 9:30, as she'd said, these really strange screeching noises started to come from the wood. One of the people who was present was a local agricultural and horticultural officer, somebody who was completely au fait with the countryside and the noises that animals made. And he says himself that I'd never heard any animal or anything in the natural world make noises like these. They were just weird, like kind of screeching sounds. And then shortly after that, this was like, I'd totally gobsmacked me. There was like these five balls of brilliant white light rose into the air above the trees. We were all just standing there staring. It lit up the whole area around. We could see each other, you know, before it had been darkness. They merged together as one large ball of light, I don't know, 8 feet across perhaps, which started silently drifting towards us before exploding with this blinding light and an ear-shattering bang. And at that, Marion just said, right, the power of the stone's discharged, and we all just got out of there as quickly as possible. I think it was the next day we went back to find the stone. And that literally was the end of it. There was no more paranormal stuff going on in the house. It remained empty for a long time. It didn't suddenly come back together after falling apart. Eventually it was bought, sold, and then turned into apartments. And as far as I know, to this day, it's an ordinary house with no haunting whatsoever.
Wow. Wow. Now, is it the case, I know, in some states here in the United States, you have to disclose whenever things like that have occurred, like if you've had a death on the property, if you have a history of haunting or anything like that. Is that the case there in the UK?
There isn't such a law. Yeah, I mean, literally, you could have a place that's supposed to have had... No, not at all. It's completely...
Do you, as a formal paranormal investigator and researcher into such areas, do you find that responsible?
I don't know. I mean, I'm no lawyer.
Well, I mean, just as an experiencer of the paranormal. Well,
personally, a few years ago, 20 years ago, I tried to buy the place. I was going to turn it into a museum.
Sure.
But loads of people, I mean, they didn't have any problem selling the place because I couldn't afford what they were asking for it. And really, in this country, it's different to the States. There are famous houses that I know of in this country that are haunted. It puts the price up. So people making up stories. It's not a place in this there's not a public place, a hotel in, or a pub in this country that doesn't claim to have ghosts. So it's the opposite as it is in the States.
True.
I think
true.
The law is I can see that. To not tell people a place is haunted.
That's right. That's right.
But you did mention about the stone and what happened to it. I mean, I didn't keep the stone myself. A casket, somebody else did it. This lady, Marion, who was the one who'd come up with the idea about discharging it, she got to keep it. And one of her family eventually sold it. And because she has been, you know, dead for a good few years now. I mean, a lot of the people involved in all this were a lot older than myself and Andy, so since passed from natural causes. We have no idea where it is, and that's why I said at the beginning, if anybody knows where it is, please let us know.
Yeah, yeah, because, I mean, what an incredible story, what an incredible piece of paranormal history to have been hip-deep involved in, Graham, and especially something that steeled you in such a way that it led you down the path of research and discovery into so many realms of knowledge.
Well, it is the thing that started me writing all these books. I mean, if you go to my website, grahamphillips.net, and you look at the first page, you'll see the books that I've written. They're all there. You can click on them and get all information about all the books. But you'll see that they're nearly all about researching into ancient relics, lost artifacts, but they don't all involve the paranormal.
No.
The Green Stone is what was the only kind of paranormal story that I wrote, really. I mean, there was a follow-up, but that hasn't been in print for years. But I decided that the Green Stone, it was a good idea, 40 years on exactly, to bring it out as this 40th anniversary edition, which is hasn't changed. It's written as it was at the time, but there are a lot more pictures in it. And for most people, because that book's been out of print for years, they wouldn't be able to get hold of it. So this is a 40th anniversary special presentation book. I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah.
And it's available on Amazon and wherever you'd normally get books from.
Yeah, and incredibly well priced. Not one of those books that's like, hey, yeah, go out and buy my book, and it's like $54. I think I picked it up for like $15 on Amazon in paperback, something like that. And so incredibly well written. Your writing style and the way that you tell story and weave history with science and lore is so incredibly well done. I can only imagine the fact that you are a favorite uncle to many, many nephews and nieces, with your storytelling style.
Thank you very much.
So, you are always welcome to come on this show to weave your stories, to tell us about these incredible events, these incredible items, these incredible things like the Green Stone, Excalibur, all the great things that you have researched through your many, many years. As we do let you go, Graham, because I know you do have other shows coming up this evening, as you are doing huge promotional push for the 40th anniversary of the Green Stone, do let everybody know where they can go to check out that Green Stone documentary and where they can go once again to buy any of your books.
Yeah, the Greenstone documentary. I have a YouTube channel. It's called Graham Phillips Author. And if you go there, you'll see all that. I make my own films about all sorts of things that I do. And I did this half-hour film about the Greenstone. It shows you all the places that I've been talking about. But what's fascinating about this Greenstone video is it even has interviews, rare footage taken of the people involved back in 1979. So, you know, that's where you can get it. Graham Phillips Author, that's my YouTube page. And basically, to find out anything else about me, to get the book, just get it on Amazon.com, The Green Stone. And as I say, check out my website, grahamphillips.net. That'll give you links to my Facebook and everything.
Absolutely. Well, please do hold the line as we close out, Graham. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and our audience about the amazing history of the Green Stone. While you are online, checking out the other great work of Graham Phillips, stop on by dudesandbeer.com. That is where you can hear all the episodes. That's where you can find the store. That's where you can find the Knowledge Vault. Make sure to check us out on the HC Universal Network as well, hcuniversalnetwork.com. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.